Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 103 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. You can join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm, or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. Peter Duisberg has been a thorn in the side of the AIDS and cancer establishments since 1987, when he wrote a paper explaining why no retroviruses, including HIV, could cause disease in any animal. Before then, Duisberg was seen as a wunderkind who, in 1970, isolated the first cancer virus known as an oncogene. On the basis of this and other work he'd done, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1986, was elected California Scientist of the Year, and received a 7-year Outstanding Investigator grant from the National Institutes of Health. But that all came to a crashing halt after the publication of this one paper. Annoying the AIDS establishment was not enough for Duisberg. He also came to the conclusion that cancer was not caused by mutations, not by oncogenes, but by the wrong number of chromosomes, a state known as aneuploidy. It has, in fact, been known since the early 1900s that all cancer tumors are aneuploid, but because nobody could understand the seemingly random patterns, no significance was given to this major observation. Duisberg has received a lot of punishment as a dissident scientist. He has been completely cut off from government funding and has almost completely lost his ability to publish in scientific journals. His latest paper on AIDS was accepted by the editor of Medical Hypotheses, published on the website, but withdrawn before paper publication at the request of the publisher, Elsevier. The publisher also fired the editor, who was not happy at his editorial independence being removed. Yet still, at the age of almost 80, in his lab at the University of Berkeley, and because he's a tenured professor, the university cannot get rid of him, with a tiny amount of private funding, he continues to pursue his cancer research in his laboratory. And although his views are still only supported by a minority of scientists, support for them is growing, even by scientists who dare not reference his paper or mention his name. So I'm here today talking with Dr. Peter Duisberg in his lab at the University of California at Berkeley. And Peter, welcome to the show.
Well, very good.
It's
now
good.
You couldn't get Weinberg, you got me. Isn't it?
Well, we could discuss who yeah. Weinberg is, but I'd much rather talk to
Weinberg,
you.
Weinberg, Duisberg's all the same.
Okay. I'm not so sure about that.
You can
so
tell him.
Okay. Mark Weinberg being one of the
No, I
the
mean
AIDS
now
missionaries.
Robert Weinberg. About Weinberg, the Robert Weinberg is someone who turned you down, isn't it? Not the Mark Weinberg. Maybe Mark Weinberg too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But didn't you try to get Robert Weinberg?
Oh, yes, on cancer, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, maybe it's something to do with the name Weinberg, because I tried to talk to Mark Weinberg doesn't talk to me, he's an AIDS researcher, and Robert Weinberg declined the offer to talk about cancer. We'll talk about cancer in a little bit. But it was, 1987 is almost 30 years ago, and that's when I think you first questioned whether HIV is the cause of AIDS.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think in that paper from 1987, you questioned whether any retrovirus can cause human disease. So what was your logic for saying that a retrovirus like HIV could not cause disease in humans?
There were several. Yeah. One of them is the virus AIDS theory, or hypothesis, I should call it, because I think it's not really a theory, of Gallo und, in a sense, also of Montagnier, holds that HIV is killing T cells.
Right.
And as a result, you become immune deficient. And as a result of that, you get a number of infectious diseases, and oddly, on top of this, also some non-infectious diseases like cancer and weight loss and dementia.
Right. I mean,
this is blamed on a virus killing T cells. And that is the first thing that contradicted everything I knew about retroviruses. Retroviruses were hyped up and highly developed and studied. I came all the way from Europe to study them here with many others,
right,
including Gallo, as causes of cancer. And the one distinction characteristic they have is they do not kill cells. And that is the primary characteristic for a cancer virus.
Well, that's an important point. So if a virus is going to cause cancer, it should cause the cells to multiply faster,
exactly,
so that you cause a cancer.
Yeah.
So it's the opposite. And that was a problem Robert Gallo had. Like, he described the virus as HTLV 1 and 2, which supposedly caused T cells to multiply faster and cause leukemia.
Yeah.
And then he came and said, well, HIV is mine, and I'm going to call it HTLV 3. And it does the opposite. It kills T cells.
Well, he said everything about this. First, he said it was also another leukemia virus.
Right.
And then when AIDS came in, he said, okay, well, this one must kill it then. So he changed his mind about what it does.
Well, he changed the name. It used to be the human T cell
leukemia
virus, and then it became the human T cell lymphotropic virus.
That was...
Which could... Then it could do either... Either...
Yeah, one.
One.
Yeah.
So what about killing...
So the first concern or this reservation or objection I had to this theory is a retrovirus, which is inherently not cytosidal, not killing cells.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's activating is yet another question, but is not ever cytosidal, is blamed for a disease that is in turn... attributed to the loss of T cells.
And T cells are probably more commonly called CD4 cells.
Well, whatever you call it.
Right. But it's just for the listener's point of view.
That
when people, now they talk about counting CD4 cells, and that's a type of T
that's
cell, right?
That's a T cell. T-cell.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was the evidence that HIV was associated with the loss of T cells? Was there any evidence? Back then?
The original papers from Gallo couldn't find HIV in AIDS patients. They only found antibody against it.
Right.
And even that, in these four science papers, the four pack in 84, which is considered the most prestigious and most whatever is any journal, the most...
The Journal Science.
The Journal Science, yeah.
Yeah.
The one best peer-reviewed and what have you.
Right.
And even in that first paper, he didn't find antibodies against the virus. Virus he didn't find. Well, he claimed in another one he may have found some virus indirectly. But antibody was only in less than half of them. So
That's right, yes.
That means even if you equate antibody against the virus with virus, which is a big equation to do, you know,
right,
it's like,
yes,
yeah, so that is really not, they're not really comparable, it's the opposite almost.
Right, if
even
I have...
Even then, only half of them were positive, and that violates even the first of so-called Koch's postulates.
It
has to be present if it's a candidate for Koch's.
It has to be present in all of them.
Yeah, in all of them, and that was less than half of them, so even the first postulate, which is by far not proof yet, wasn't met. Yet it was in Science, and everybody said, aha, and let's give us some money and study it. Yeah.
And so what did he grow the HIV in his lab in?
He grew it in T-cell lines.
But it kills T-cells.
It should, but it didn't.
So he was growing large quantities, supposedly, of HIV in the cells that HIV is supposed to kill.
Kill, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
what I pointed out, actually, as a real contradiction with his own theory in that first paper. You claim it's killing T cells, and you claim you can mass produce it as a test for antibodies in patients, and then have test for it in T cells, which are immortal. They're growing now. You can get these T cells now.
Right. But another problem.
They're still growing 30 years later.
They grow forever.
Yeah.
And those, some of those cells are the, they were cells taken from a black woman, Henrietta Lacks, the H.
No, no, that's HeLa.
That's HeLa. These are not HeLa. It's different.
No, it's different.
Okay.
These were cell lines that were infected. One of them probably came from Montagnier with a B or T cell line, some lymphocyte cell lines.
I mean, another problem with the whole AIDS concept is that there are no AIDS diseases that are unique to AIDS, right? Like all 30 or so diseases, like cervical cancer, tuberculosis, various fungal infections, bacterial infections, Kaposi sarcoma, PCP pneumonia, those have all been found prior to the era of AIDS in people for which HIV was not believed to be the cause.
Yeah.
So couldn't they say, okay, we found antibodies in half the people, therefore only half of them had AIDS. Couldn't they say that?
Well, they didn't. They could have said it, but then the paper wouldn't have been published in Science, probably.
Because
even Science would have noticed that that's a bit weak, wait until you find it in all of
Right, because then you're basically saying, well, when they stood up in 1984 and said, we have found the probable cause of AIDS, they would have had to stand up and say, we have found the probable cause for half of AIDS.
Yeah, or the hypothetical.
And we're still looking for the other half.
In this case, it would be more like hypothetical cause.
Yes,
half of AIDS.
We may have discovered the hypothetical cause
in half
possibly
of
could be
in
half the
of
cause
the
in half of the...
Yes.
Okay, so that would have been a bit of a problem.
To sell it that way.
Yes. I mean, has anybody got anywhere with connecting HIV to CD4 cells today? I mean, we're now 30 years later, right? From 1987, when you first wrote your first paper. Has anybody got any evidence that HIV kills T cells, CD4 cells?
Not really, no. I don't know of any papers that really say. Well, I mean, Gallo and others say when you put T cells in culture and you add HIV, some cells die or not all cells grow. But that's not surprising. T cells don't like to grow. Normal T cells don't grow well in culture at all. Only cell lines do.
Yeah, cell death seems like an awfully crude marker. Like,
well,
if
it were really a straight cytotoxic virus, it would be very good because you could infect a million cells. It was say take polio or take measles or take sendai or take mumps. You put it on today, and 2 days later, virtually all cells are dead if you can infect them. That's straightforward enough.
And you should be able to put a drop in your on your petri dish or whatever, and it should go out from that.
That's correct.
Point.
Yeah.
So there would be really good evidence. That So
That is not the case. I mean, they didn't ever show. Never even show. And if it they had, you wouldn't have missed it.
Right. And also, I mean, AIDS diseases, AIDS is a syndrome, so diseases I mentioned like tuberculosis, whatever, those diseases all exist without HIV. They've all existed well before the era of HIV.
All of them.
But also CD4, there have been many papers on CD4 cells that show that other things change the number of CD4 cells. Like I've read that smoking causes CD4 counts to go up, which should mean, no, pardon me, smoking? Yeah, smoking causes them to go up, which should mean that smoking's good for you. I mean, have you looked into any of the papers on other reasons for CD4 cell counts to change?
I think there are endless ones that they can go up and down. They're quite seasonal anyway.
Daily?
They can go up with food and sleep and no sleep and no food.
And exercise.
And exercise. I mean, the steady level is... You have to average it out to get a steady level, to get a solid level on as a background to then change.
Right.
It's not such an easy thing to do. And in fact, the natural range is going, I think it's from 200 to 2,000. It's a tenfold range, which are all, quote, normal.
Right.
You're normal with 200 and you're normal with 2,000.
And there's been healthy people who've been discovered to have very, very low counts.
Yeah, very low, like 200 and even less.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there, I've heard, I haven't looked this up myself, that there's people dying of AIDS who have very high CD4 counts.
I assume so too. I mean, it hasn't been
So, I mean, if CD4 cells were used as a marker for HIV, then it should be true that HIV is the only thing that changes the quantity of CD4 counts, for CD4 cells.
CD4, if that were the direct cause, yes, it definitely should.
Right, and the fact that other things could change, like, for example, if stress could change CD4 counts, and you find out you're HIV positive and you get stressed out because you're going to die, or you think you're going to die, then that might make your CD4 counts go up or down, which would be interpreted as your HIV is killing your CD4 cells. So the modern, I mean,
but stress is sort of such a vague thing in science to deal with, you know. Who isn't under stress? Everybody has some form of stress. I mean, you can stress out over dates and drugs, but over careers and over kids and over anything.
If you hear somebody give a talk that you disagree with, that can be very stressful.
Yeah, many, and even if you give one, that is it can also be stressful. Stress is a so relative, subjective thing. It's not a good measure for science, a good start for science.
Right. I mean, there is no unambiguous measure of stress.
Stress is not a scientific word. It is used to mask ignorance, or let's say, non-knowledge.
When I grew up as a kid who was interested in science and I studied science in university, my idea about science was that scientists kept arguing over theories, and they didn't stop until the very last person had given up on a particular side, right? So if some people thought that the continents moved and other people didn't, they'd spend years arguing over that, and then eventually everybody would agree that the continents moved, and then science can say, okay, that's as close to fact as we're going to get. So what
but
did you see?
It was mostly experimental evidence or some other evidence that made the decision.
On continents?
Yeah.
It was actually accidental because it was actually more similar to AIDS. But I think after the Second World War, the U.S. Navy was doing experiments in the Atlantic Ocean, and they discovered these magnetic lines where some pointed north and some pointed south. And nobody could explain that except by saying that the center of the center of the universe is spreading. The center of the ocean is spreading, and the magnetic north and south are swapping every few thousand years. So it was an accident that overthrew that theory. I was being slightly sarcastic, but what did you see happening when, after Robert Gallo in 1984, April, May 1984, stood up at a press conference with Margaret Heckler and with the force of the U.S. government behind him said, we've discovered the probable cause of AIDS, or maybe Heckler said that. What did you see happening in science in terms of open discussion about what was actually the cause of AIDS?
Well, obviously, very, very little. That's why I wrote that paper. Yeah. It was, from the very beginning, connected to mega funding, huge funds for dealing or neutralizing a vaccine, obviously, was the ultimate goal of the research to prevent AIDS.
I think they promised a vaccine in 2 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there was abundant funding for this because the ground was well prepared by the New York Times and all its followers that we are on the verge of an imminent global, heterosexual population epidemic.
Right.
And everybody would be at risk. So the Congress and the politicians respond very well to threats like this, and pressures in particular. And they made huge amounts of funds available from the very beginning. And
would
scientists
you say
respond favorably to huge amounts of funds?
Retroviruses were being studied for cancer.
Yeah.
You were studying retroviruses.
Yeah, yes,
cancer.
Yes. That was a specific goal.
And how much progress were they making?
Actually, they made a tiny bit of progress with animal models, some selective things. But they never got over the one very basic hurdle that was known 100 years ago or 200 years ago, that cancer is not contagious.
Right.
If viruses were the cause of cancer, cancers should be contagious.
Right, right.
And that is actually the same hurdle or problem with AIDS. AIDS, is, if it's a viral disease and people are jailed for it, it's not contagious. There's no good evidence if it, that it is contagious.
Well, yeah, like the Padian study from 1997.
Well, you don't need the Padian study. Look at 300 million Americans producing 5 million babies a year.
Right.
If there were a contagious sexually transmitted agent that wasn't there before, for which we don't have a natural vaccine and don't have an artificial one either, well, guess what would happen? Boom. It would go up like syphilis, like gonorrhea, or like any other contagious disease. Nothing except you don't need any particular people. You look at 300 million people, or if you like to include the whole universe, take the 6 billion people. Where did an epidemic spread of AIDS occur that was exponential, as it would be in a sexually transmitted epidemic? Nothing there.
Yes. I mean, AIDS grew quite rapidly in the in the 1980s.
In the literature, yes. They used tests. The testing went up exponentially.
Plus,
that's what the doctors
plus
and the scientists did. Yeah.
They expanded the definition
several times. Yeah. So they tried to create an epidemic of antibodies first, and when they've had enough antibodies, you know, AIDS, then they invented more and more, or put into the so-called symptoms. It's not even a disease, it's a symptom now. More and more diseases to get those up too.
I mean, one of the mysteries to me is why, after they started with two diseases, PCP pneumonia and Kaposi sarcoma, and by 1987 they had 30 diseases.
Yeah.
And then in 1993 they added a low CD4 count as part of the definition of AIDS.
Yeah.
And despite doing all of that, the number of cases started to go down. I've never understood that.
Well,
they were still testing.
I don't know whether this was a true go up and go down. They were always at this very low, low level in absolute numbers. It was never more than 70 or 80,000 per year. That was at the highest level.
Yeah.
But many of these were rush diagnosis without even antibody testing. And the antibody tests were not standardized. They had to. They were became more sensitive and less sensitive, and added webs. They added not the Western plot, and then they added the PCR and
right different tests.
And they add all everything together to get it up, and then finally they standardized it more, and flat it was, and flat it stayed.
That's true. That the definition of AIDS actually says for some diseases, if you have a confirmed diagnosis, you can diagnose AIDS in the absence of an HIV test.
Mm.
So if you were a gay man walking into a doctor's office in the 1980s with Kaposi sarcoma, good chance you're going to get an AIDS diagnosis, and they're not even going to bother to do an HIV test.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that cancer researchers jumped on the AIDS bandwagon because they were concerned that if they weren't going anywhere, that they were going to start to see cuts to the cancer virus funding?
Yeah, I don't think they are so visionary, but I mean, the AIDS researchers were all retrovirologists in the big, the new ones,
right?
Except the doctors outside, but in science,
right?
These were retrovirologists. They had all studied retrovirus, including this one, as a cause of cancer,
right?
Me, so and that didn't pay off. I mean, it was interesting academically, and it produced some interesting results on how viruses and how you can infect cells and without killing them and tracking it down and these kind of things you could study quite well. But it became more and more obvious that we didn't find them in humans. And Gallo and Spiegelman and many of those guys were trying desperately, at least with all possible.
I mean, maybe it was like
to find it in human cancer, and it didn't come out.
Let me give you an analogy. Maybe is this reasonably accurate? Mm-hmm. So, in the middle of the 20th century, it was frowned upon for women to smoke. So, if you were a cigarette company and you said, you know, we've saturated the market amongst men, but there's a very low percentage of women smoking.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this huge new market, right?
Yeah.
And AIDS maybe was like that, where where there was zero funding for AIDS to start with, so the sky was the limit, right? You now had a new reason for funding. It wasn't going to reduce your cancer funding. It was going to increase your lab's funding if you started studying AIDS and cancer. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it was. But, I mean, for retrobiologists, it was... The attraction was declining because they couldn't come up with a human retrovirus.
Right.
And so they were under pressure to justify their premier status in the field.
Right.
They were, retrovirologists were the number one cancer researchers in the 60s, 70s.
Right.
They had the knowledge and they had the answers, presumably.
And they had the funding.
Absolutely, yeah. Plenty of it. The Special Virus Cancer Program, Hübner,
right.
So had raised that. That was very generous funding, very lavish funding.
Right.
And they had some interesting things scientifically to show for themselves. These viruses that wouldn't kill cells would seem to transform.
Interesting
them.
From a lab point of view, not necessarily interesting from
basic
a human...
Basic science, yeah.
Basic
then
science.
The reverse transcriptase, look at this, the virus can do everything.
And are they still, is the government still funding retrovirus research in cancer?
Much less now. You don't read much about it anymore, and the government is not funding as much anymore. Yeah, no.
That was
a move for many of the established retrovirus labs to move from studying retrovirus causing cancer now to study the retrovirus causing
right.
AIDS.
We
the Jay Levy and the Bob Gallo
right.
and the Montagnier
Robin
Weiss. And the Robin Weiss and the Varmus and many of the big names are all retrovirologists who've moved over
to the AIDS.
And
now one of the big things
for that reason, because now there was funding and there was glory to begin it, fame to begin. Maybe.
They are saying that HPV is a cause of cancer.
But wait, that's yet another virus. So.
Right, it's not a retrovirus.
No, it's a DNA. It's a wart virus. It's a wart virus.
And what do you think about the connection between HPV and cervical cancer and other kinds of cancers?
I have a paper on that from a year ago.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, you didn't know. No.
Yeah, I read it.
Well, it's a 30-year-old tradition of virologists when they can't get anywhere with cancer, then the connection gets further and further. Disconnect gets further and further. And in this case, the so-called slow viruses were invented.
Right.
So the wart infects you now at 20. It's sexually transmitted. Virus. I'll give you the paper.
So you go to UC Berkeley as an undergrad, you have sex, you get warts.
Yeah.
When do you die of cervical cancer?
Typically around 50, 60, 70. So you have latent periods, according to Zuhausen, who got the Nobel Prize for Montagnier, 20 to 50 years later. So that virus is very, very, very slow.
And it also, people clear the virus, right?
It's long gone. You can't find the virus in the cancer anymore. Long gone. It's the same.
So they're saying that the cancer is caused by the virus. It's not there.
Yeah. But was there.
But was there.
Years ago.
The virus is there. It does something. The virus disappears. Whatever it did stays there. And then 10,
something,
20, 30, 40, 50 years later, it turns into a cancer.
Yep. Yeah, then it makes a cancer.
I think most people don't realize with HPV is that the vaccine trials couldn't look at whether it reduced the risk of cancer because of this long latency.
But only in 20 to 50 years.
Right.
In the meantime, they're paying dearly for it.
They didn't want to wait 20 to 50 years to sell the vaccine.
No.
Right? So what were they looking at that convinced them that these people were more likely to be on the way to cancer if they didn't get vaccinated?
Well, that you have to ask them. They say they say it's reasonable and it's harmless and it's protecting your daughter 20 to 30 years from now from cancer. Wouldn't you want to pay for this, Daddy? And Daddy says, of course, I want to spare my girl cancer death in 30 years when I'm also no longer around to celebrate it.
Right.
Something like that.
Yes. But I mean, you can get parents to do a lot. It's like if you go to a woman who's pregnant and say, you're HIV positive, if you want to save your baby, you got to take AZT.
Yeah.
Most women will take it, and even if they start throwing up and they start feeling sick, they will still do it because they desperately want to protect their child, whether it's born or unborn.
Yeah.
And I think the same, if you go to a mother with a 12-year-old girl and say, do you want to protect your girl against cancer or not, then your daughter, they'd all say yes, but they're not told, we actually haven't proven that this vaccine prevents cancer, we've just shown that it's associated with less precancerous lesions.
In fact, the proof is there, but they don't, again, connect it. You have, that's all they really detect in most women, like 80 to 90% of the population, female and male, are antibody positive.
For HPV?
HPV. It's essentially ubiquitous. It's
right.
An old, ubiquitous, harmless virus. And once you had a wart somewhere, genital or wherever it is, in your face or somewhere, you make antibodies and it slowly disappears. And you have antibodies for the rest of your life.
Right.
And the vaccine is raising the same antibodies, but for another $1,500. And 10,000 cases in per year in the US get cervical cancer, and half the vaccine, the natural one, and it doesn't help. But we don't talk about that. We don't explain
we'll
that.
See
we see
how
the
trends in cancer go.
Well, we have antibodies, and we have trends for cervical cancer for about 60, 70 years, ever since pap smears were around.
Right.
And guess how it's going. Down, it went from the most popular or most common female cancer in the 50s and before,
right,
to the least common, to the below the 10 most common ones. It's way down,
right.
And now we put in a vaccine. Say, see, oh, it's way down.
If
it was going down to below the most common 10 before they had the vaccine, and now they say in 20 years it will be even downer than it is now.
So if they start the graph the year they came out with the vaccine, they're going to show the graph going down.
Yeah.
But if you started the graph 50 years before the vaccine,
it exists.
You would realize
you can look it up.
Yes.
That graph exists. That was one of the major successes in cancer research or preventing
was the pap smear.
Was the pap smear. And this is actually that's what I'm doing. We are looking what's happening in these cells. What's happening in the cancer cells? How do they differ from the uninfected cells or from non-cancerous cells? Not in HIV, HPV, that could be there or not there.
Right.
But what you see in the cancer cells, you see a new clonal karyotype, a huge difference in
chromosomes. So you're talking about aneuploidy,
yes,
which is the wrong
karyotype.
Number of chromosomes.
Which is the total number of chromosomes. In your typical cervical cancer, you have 70, 80 chromosomes.
And what's the normal human?
46.
So 46 chromosomes is normal, and you're saying that in a cancerous cell, you have a larger number. Now, does every cancerous cell have the same number?
No,
of extra
everyone
chromosomes?
Has an individual one. It's like a species. The cancer is like a new species. It calls independently of your own body. It's autonomous calls. Autonomy is the primary definition, biological, but of a species. A species is defined by something that can autonomously replicate and exist without any other species consensus or help.
When a cancer cell which has, say, 75 chromosomes divides, does it produce an identical complement of chromosomes, or is it a different number?
That's what we found. That is actually was always debated, but we have now very clear evidence that it's clonal, meaning identical, as a identical karyotype in all of them. It is, say, quasi-identical. It is flexible.
Okay.
In a certain range, it's flexible. And that is what couldn't be seen with the methods and the way it was looked at before. It was considered, oh, it's varying all the time. There must be something clonal behind it. But there isn't anything clonal behind it. The virus was, of course, one of the things.
So you're basically saying that the cell divides, it's approximately the same number of chromosomes.
Very close, yeah.
But, of course, it's
clonal.
Approximate. And you divide 100 times, what you end up at the end of 100 times is going to be quite different?
No,
be
same.
75 still?
It's the same karyotype, just flexible
all the
time.
Wouldn't that mean that a tumor, that every cell in the tumor has the same number of
yes,
chromosomes?
Yes, exactly what we found, yeah.
Yeah. That's what you found?
Yeah.
Now, how long has it been known that... Oh, thank you. Oh my goodness, that's a big paper.
Well, it's a lot of pictures in it, and we didn't put it in the supplement. It's
right.
As big as it appears at first sight, and it's not painted in a blue page. On four sides of paper can make you a better thing.
No, this is fine.
But it, it's...
So,
it,
how...
See, so here you see, that's the graphic that we sort of, quote, invented. So here you can so this would be a what we call a karyotype array of a normal female.
Right.
So these are 20 chromosomes lined up in this way. Here are the chromosome numbers.
Right.
And here are the chromosome copy numbers. So
right.
If you're normal, you have two copies for every chromosome, total
right.
46, 22 so-called autosomes, and then two sex chromosomes in
right.
girls.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. Perfect girl here.
Right.
For you. With or without HPV.
Right.
80% of them have HPV.
Right.
And you don't see anything carried.
Yes.
Somewhere in the middle. And now he has one cervical cancer. If it were random, it would be all over the place. But no, it has a new pattern. This cancer is 20 or 30 years in culture, hasn't changed. I mean, it jumps a bit here, jumps a bit there, but the
basically,
it oscillates within margins, narrow margins. You would always recognize that cancer.
Okay, so I need to talk to the audience.
Mm.
So what you're showing me is that in a normal human female,
yeah.
Chromosomes 1 to 22 are in pairs.
Yeah,
and
even the X is in pair. In the
and
females,
there's a,
yeah.
yes, a female have
all
a pair of X's and no Y.
All of them are pairs. Yeah.
But what you're showing me for this cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Is it looks like there is about 35
yeah.
chromosomes,
yeah.
and some of them it looks like they have three
yes,
instead
yes.
of two,
yeah.
and some they only have one,
yes, that's
and
correct.
Some zero.
Zero and what is it? There wouldn't be any life without any chromosome 18. That's broken up into pieces. You can see 18 here and everything
oh.
here in the cancer cell. You have these; they're called marker chromosomes. Because that's happening only in the cancer cells. If you had that in normal cells, the cell would be...
So a cancer might be started when a chromosome breaks in half?
When
and then when that cell reproduces?
It's like essentially a major fragmentation of chromosomes, recombination of new chromosomes.
Right, so the...
Numbers and structures
so
change.
When you have a cancer cell...
Mm.
which is aneuploid, which has mm. more chromosomes than it's supposed to.
Yeah.
It's not really more chromosomes, it's that some of them have broken into pieces.
Arranged in different pieces. It's
right.
literally like speciation. If you
right.
create a gorilla, or me, a dog, my chromosomes, the chromosomes in all mammals, or the genes in all mammals are more or less the same. It would
right.
be broken up into 70 chromosomes if my son were a dog or my daughter.
Right.
And if it were your son were gorilla or daughter, it would be 48. Sorry,
right.
two more.
And 48. If you try to combine sperm and egg from
yeah.
animals that have different number of chromosomes, that's just going to die.
99.89% down the toilet.
Right.
God is number one eugenicist.
right.
Hitler is a joke compared to him. You would not be born with an abnormal karyotype.
Well, even
most
like Down syndrome is like one extra chromosome.
It's
right?
one, but it's borderline, and that's the mildest or the less massive or the least aneuploidy you can have.
Right.
You have an extra chromosome of the smallest.
I mean, even with just that one change,
yeah.
people with Down syndrome have a lot of extra illness.
Oh yeah.
They have a shorter life, although it's getting better than it used to be.
Yeah.
And they have mental capacity problems.
Lots of problems.
Yes.
Yeah. Others too.
Just
heart,
one,
heart
but you're talking about many more than one
yeah,
in this.
Yeah.
So how long has it been known that cancer cells have the wrong number of chromosomes?
Well, in a way, it is known, quote, for 100 years. Boveri, you heard that name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or von Hanselmann, they said they have normal chromosomes. But they all expected, thinking like geneticists would do, it couldn't be any change in the chromosome, because then all of us would have cancer.
Right.
Changes happen, there's a low risk, 1 in 100 or 1,000, of any mitosis that a chromosome goes wrong, and then
right.
it sits there. So they said it got to be something specific. And that was the fatal trap for this karyotypic theory. People were looking for a specific karyotype, not normal.
Right.
Maybe like this, but then they would want to see it in all cervical cancers.
Oh, okay. So they would, if it was 75 chromosomes in one cervical cancer, they'd want
75
all to have the same 75.
Yeah, they could say okay.
And then they could say okay.
Say the lung cancer could be 64, and the liver cancer could be this. But what they found is, for every cancer, they look at cervical cancer here. It's clonal, yes. It is a different pattern, and here. And here, that's why the paper is long. It just makes the same point. These are all cervical cancers, all of them.
Right.
And they all have different karyotypes.
Right.
So that killed the... That essentially was the nemesis of the Boveri or abnormal karyotype theory, because they couldn't find anything consistent.
Right. So you take... the cancer cells from one woman with cervical cancer, and they have a certain number of chromosomes, and all the cells are approximately the same.
Yes.
But then you go to the next woman with a very similar cancer,
yeah.
and she's got a different number of chromosomes, and all hers look the same, but just to herself.
Exactly out here. Yeah. Mm.
But the modern theory of cancer is that it's mutations that cause
cancer. Well, we are not finished yet.
Okay.
So this was a state when we sort of moved in, like, 20 years ago now, like
right.
it took me over 10 years to figure out an explanation for this slowly.
Yes.
I mean, it's in there somewhere, here and then mentioned, but never shown. So what about we are so primed to think when everything goes wrong it's a mutation,
right.
or we're killing cells, but the speciation, that's the biggest change you could do genetically, but it happens
right.
so rarely, because it's so improbable that out of one autonomous karyotype, by random changes,
mm-hmm.
you get a new one.
Right.
That it's so extremely rare. And certainly with something as complex as us, it's even more rare. It happens every couple of million years.
Right.
Or maybe it's as God comes and plays roulette, does it for us. But with cancer, you go down from a highly complicated multicellular organism to practically back to E. coli. It's a
right.
self-replicating thing with any... without any differentiated, hardly any differentiated function. Now it can happen more readily, and it does. So is it speciation? What is the prediction of a species we talked about? It's autonomous, that's biologically, and it's individual. Every species you don't ever make the same species again, because the odds of coming up with an autonomous karyotype, a scrambling one, is so incredibly low that it never happens twice.
I think we need to explain.
Mm.
You said that it's not differentiated. Like, by differentiation, you mean that some cells in your body are muscle cells.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
Some are.
Yeah, that one is
blood
lost.
Vessels.
Yeah. Mm.
But cancer goes sort of reverts to a generic cell type that doesn't really have a particular function.
It's just
a cell.
It goes down to the very essential metabolic or household functions, making DNA, RNA, protein, burning sugar and burning and pissing and this kind of
right.
things.
Right, so just survival. I mean, a cancer cell is not trying to become a nerve cell, it's not trying to become a muscle cell.
Sometimes there are traces of it left in there,
right.
yes. But it, on the whole, it's too messed up to become what we are again. For that,
right.
you need... very careful, if it's in evolution even, very minor little changes to go from one to another.
Right.
It does seem to happen, but we have never reproduced in a lab. This one you can reproduce in a lab. So the speciation was the only explanation for carcinogenesis. You get a new autonomous thing. It has its own karyotype, individual, and individual phenotypes. And that solved the dilemma that the cytogeneticists faced since Boveri's days almost 100 years ago. When they did karyotypes, they couldn't see these patterns because they didn't plot it this way, and they didn't ask it this way.
So if we were to go back in time within an individual who has cancer, you're saying that there was a point in time where one cell went crazy?
Yes.
And
only.
What's that?
Only one.
Only one cell. Mm. So one cell tries to divide, and it totally messes it up.
Yeah.
Like what normally happens if a cell in my body divides and mitosis, the division of cells, all screwed up, and I end up, the two cells end up with the wrong number of chromosomes. Yeah. So it normally happens.
Typically, the one of two things. Either it sits there and doesn't do much at all and doesn't function well.
Yeah.
It's packaged. That is part of aging.
Right.
You pick up more and more cells in your lung or that don't pick up oxygen anymore.
Okay.
And you have a harder time going upstairs.
Right, I've noticed.
You do. It's still there. It's still the same lung, and you're still the same 100 kilo guys or 70 kilo guys, whatever it is. But it doesn't work as well anymore as it did when you were 18. Yeah, all of these things.
Right.
So that's one thing, that you accumulate cells with chromosomal changes and mutations.
And so less functional cells.
Less functional cells, and in most cases with chromosomes, they're dead even. When they lose a critical chromosome, adios, they're gone.
So you said like chromosome 18 is critical. So if you divide and you drop chromosome 18,
the cell dies.
The cell will die. Okay.
Die.
So
with most mutations, that's not the case. But with chromosomes, they die very fast when there's a missing chromosome.
Right. And I mean, aneuploidy explains how you can go from one cell to a tumor if this cell can divide quickly, then it can produce a tumor. But most, I would say most cancer researchers and most people still believe that mutations cause cancer.
Yeah, of course they do. Yeah, that's the prevailing theory. We are up against the same theory again. Yeah.
Are you making any headway with this theory about aneuploidy? Are you facing the same thing with AIDS?
Look at this paper. This paper gets a lot of requests. So it's
so you're talking about a paper in Molecular Cytogenetics?
Yeah,
That's a prominent journal. I don't know the cancer
journals. BMC, British Medical Biomed Central, is a British open access publisher.
Right.
It's actually connected now with Springer and even Nature. But it's a free open access journal.
Right.
And you don't. They are not as editor heavy or autocracy of an editor in a highly prestigious journal where they are very concerned, don't change anything too much. Or I myself.
Well, you've also experienced cases, especially with Elsevier, where if a paper is published in one of their journals that contradicts some major dogma, then the paper will get pulled after publication, as happened to you in Medical Hypotheses.
And see, these journals are not, they, because of a lower impact, they are not as severely controlled as the high impact, the Nature.
And yet, somebody like Robert Gallo managed to get his papers in
Science,
in Science, which is like the top American journal, pretty much. And even though there's been tremendous problems with those papers over the years,
even from the beginning, as we pointed out, he missed the reviewers, or whoever is the so-called peer review, which they are so concerned about, missed the most fundamental law in infectious disease, the Koch's postulate number one. Gallo showed only half of his guys had whatever is not even virus, antibody against virus. They were not even in contact with it ever.
Yes.
And yet, because political pressure prevails, they published it anyway because they were sure they would get a high circulation and a high whatever.
Well, I think it was a race to be the first.
Whatever, it's always
to publish on.
But I mean, the publicity was high enough, thanks to New York Times and all the journals that fell into place. They like any secret. That was the Zika virus of the day, but a little bit better. They had the AIDS guys dying, so and all this politics behind it. From Liz Taylor to...
Yes, I don't know if any virus is ever going to have the impact of AIDS. Like, it's hard, I think, for Americans to get worked up about a virus that causes birth defects in Brazil.
Well, they're on the way now.
There's some energy, but I don't know. I don't feel I mean, you were around, obviously, at the beginning of the time,
yeah.
like in San Francisco. Like, what was the atmosphere in San Francisco at the early days of the AIDS epidemic in terms of people's perception, fear, things like that?
Yeah, like I'm sure you were too. They were all afraid getting infected, and it was an infectious disease.
I mean, there were demonstrations. I don't know if in San Francisco, but in some cities, there were demonstrations against the government for not providing medications and things like that.
The band played his own,
capitalizes
on it perfectly.
I haven't seen any demonstrations for the Zika virus.
No. No, it's not enough propaganda. They have to work up it.
They have to work much more at that. It's the same with Ebola. Like, it was a big deal for a few months,
and then
it's
gone.
It's disappeared.
Mm. And SARS and all these kinds of things. But anyway, what's critical here is then the solution of this paradox was that the prediction of a specific karyotype is true for mutations. If it were mutations, you have the same mutation for all hemophiliacs and the same mutation for all sickle cell anemias. So
right.
they expected consistent karyotype changes, at least for cancer, and that's what they always predicted, and they couldn't find it. So they said there must be something consistent behind it that we don't see with chromosomes, genes. And that's brought up the gene mutation theory and the gene theory, which we are still
With mutations, like if the mutation theory was simple, it would be mutate here, cancer, very simple, right? But in actual fact,
that would have been simple too if it were the same karyotype,
right.
for, like Down syndrome. That's a very simple situation.
They
thought it would be lung cancer would be another type of Down syndrome.
Right, but let's stick with mutations. So what they have now is this kind of Rube Goldberg machine where you have like 20, 30, 40, 50.
Yeah, it's hopeless. It's falling apart.
Interrelated mutations that have to occur.
Yeah, that's it's falling apart. Every time they sequence one, they have another 100,000 oncogenes. It's more oncogenes than normal genes.
So like you have, like maybe you have five tumors from five different women with cervical cancer. You find five different clones. Each clone looks similar to itself, like the cells within the clone look similar to itself, but between them, they don't look so similar.
They're all different, yeah.
But what does it look like with mutations? Like if you take five people with cervical cancer, are you going to see the same mutations?
Well, the mutations that the quote mutation that they zeroed into was the Zuhausen did successfully. That was the virus, the papilloma virus. That was the mutation. That's an equivalent to a mutation. Here's one gene or two or three genes. They do it. That's clonal then.
So HPV is detected within your DNA?
Yeah. HPV DNA is detected. They don't find the virus anymore. It's gone. The virus is long eliminated by the immune system. You have already your vaccine.
So their theory is that the HPV virus gets integrated into your
some
DNA.
Some part of it, yeah.
And then starts causing trouble.
50 years later.
50 years later.
Yeah.
Even though it's in your DNA, so every time a cell divides, theoretically, you've got two, and then four, and then eight. Is there anything you'd like to add, Peter? To our discussion.
Yeah, have a look at this that we can see.
I will. Not only that, but I will put a link to your paper. With the show, so if people listen to the show, they can also read this scientific paper entitled "Individual Karyotypes at the Origins of Cervical Carcinoma."
Yeah.
And what is a karyotype?
That's the chromosome pattern. Your 46 chromosomes is your karyotype.
Okay, so if I have 75 in a cancer cell, that's a different karyotype.
That would be these posters there.
Compare the story of Dr. Peter Duisberg to that of Dr. Farid Fata. Peter Duisberg can't get a modest amount of funding to do research on what could be a revolutionary change in how we understand the formation of cancers. Dr. Farid Fata, by comparison, was sentenced to 45 years in federal prison for violating the trust of more than 550 patients and raking in more than $17 million from fraudulent billing. He did this by, according to the Detroit Free Press, pumping poisonous chemotherapy drugs into patients for years, telling them that they had cancer when they didn't, overtreating terminal cancer patients rather than letting them die peacefully. He also so-called undertreated patients with chemotherapy to save money, overbilling by not actually selling the amount of chemotherapy that he said. I'm not terribly convinced that chemotherapy has a lot of value, given that it's never subjected to randomized placebo-controlled clinical trials. But obviously his intention was to just make more money. This was from July of last year. Fatah, who openly wept in court as he apologized for his actions, admitted to fraudulently billing Medicare, insurance companies, and at least 550 patients through misdiagnosis, overtreatment, undertreatment. In some cases, he gave nearly four times the recommended dosage amount of aggressive cancer drugs. In at least one case, a patient was given toxic chemotherapy for 5 years when the standard treatment was 6 months, according to former patients and experts who testified in court. Fatah, in his apology, said, "I misused my talents because of power and greed. My quest for power is self-destructive." He said he was horribly ashamed of his conduct and prays for repentance. During the court hearings, about 22 victims of Dr. Fatah were heard. They shared experiences such as a healthy adult undergoing unnecessary chemotherapy and losing nearly all their teeth, of a patient diagnosed with lung cancer when they actually had kidney cancer, and more. In some cases, the statements were read by family members of patients who had died. He was arrested in 2013 and pleaded guilty in 2014 to 13 counts of healthcare fraud, 2 counts of money laundering, and 1 count of conspiring to pay and receive kickbacks. There were $34.7 million in billings to patients and insurance companies, of which at least $17.6 million was unnecessary. With 45 years in jail, it's highly unlikely that he will get out within his lifetime. But in reality, Dr. Fatah was just too greedy. He could have made millions of dollars as an oncologist, and almost all of his patients would have died, and he didn't have to ask any questions about the effectiveness of the chemotherapy. As long as he had followed the rules, he could have got away with making a huge amount of money. But he was greedier than most, and he wanted to make a whole lot more than the average oncologist, which is a lot. And he just couldn't stop. It doesn't really say that the other oncologists are doing something for the benefit of humanity. It's interesting that Dr. Farid Fatah was a colleague of David Gorski, who blogs under the name ORAC and criticizes anybody who criticizes anything about... It's interesting to note that according to some reports, Dr. Farid Fatah was a colleague of David Gorski, who blogs under the name ORAC, and who is notorious for criticizing anybody who criticizes anything about allopathic medicine. Dr. Gorski has been doing this for a long time on a blog named Respectful Insolence, and even when he attacks people who consider alternative cancer therapies, he doesn't identify himself as a cancer doctor, just as a surgeon. Thank you for listening to episode 103 of The Infectious Myth. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.